Ekatra Podcast Conversations, for the curious essential knowledge, simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome back, everyone, to the Deep Dive. Today, we are tackling, well, a really significant book. It's one that kind of shakes things up intellectually. It forces you to question the very systems we use to categorize people. I'm talking about Stephen Jay Gould's huge work, The Mismeasure of Man.
Yeah, it's a powerful one. And it's definitely more than just, you know, dry academic history. It's like a surgical dissection, really, of this long-running attempt in Western science, you know, over centuries, trying to take all the complexity of human ability, this vast, unquantifiable stuff, and just boil it down to a single number, supposedly fixed number.
Right. So that's really our core mission today, unpacking Gould's, well, massive historical debunking. And it's such a crucial lesson, isn't it, for our modern world?
Absolutely.
I mean, like, why should you care? If you're listening and you're not, say, a biologist, why care about 19th century skull measurements? Seems kind of niche.
Well, because the central idea Gould tackles, this thing called biological determinism, it's still very much alive. You know, it hasn't gone away.
Okay.
So if you're involved in, say, education or dealing with standardized tests, or even just trying to follow debates about genetics and achievement or social policy, then this book is just, well, essential. It really helps you see when maybe, just maybe, science is being used to prop up old ideas about race or class or gender.
Okay, that makes sense. Let's definitely unpack that argument.
Yeah.
But first, maybe we should properly introduce the author, Stephen Jay Gould.
Yes, definitely. He was, well, a real intellectual giant, very prominent from the 70s right up until he died in 2002. Based at Harvard, mostly known as a paleontologist and evolutionary biologist.
And he's famous for punctuated equilibrium, right? That theory about evolution happening in bursts.
Exactly. That's probably his most famous scientific contribution. It really changed how people thought about the pace of evolution.
But his background, it seems like it made him almost uniquely suited to write this specific critique. Like, he was the perfect detective for this particular case.
I think that's fair to say. He could critique it on a technical level that, frankly, most historians of science just couldn't match.
How so?
Well, first off, he was a practicing biologist and statistician, so he didn't just, you know, wave his hands at the historical data. He actually went back, got the original figures from these old studies, rolled up his sleeves, and reanalyzed them. He literally checked their math.
That's incredible. Just doing that is fascinating. But you said there was a second qualification.
Yes. And this is what really makes The Mismeasure of Man so special, I think. Gould was also a truly gifted historian of science. His goal wasn't just to say, ha ha, these old scientists were wrong. He was really focused on context, placing their work right into its social and political setting. He showed how their own biases, their assumptions about race or class, how those things fundamentally shaped the questions they asked, and crucially, how it kind of predetermined the answers they found. So it's really a book about how bias works in science, not just about calculation errors.
Okay, so that's the lens he's using, a biologist, statistician, and historian. So what's the main target? What's the central argument of the book?
The big target is biological determinism.
Okay, what does that mean exactly?
It's basically the belief that things like intelligence, maybe even behavior, your social worth, that these are fixed qualities, that they're innate, hardwired by your genes, and critically, that they can be objectively measured.
Measured with a number.
Exactly. And that these measurements then dictate your destiny, your place in the social order.
And Gould says this whole project spanning centuries is fundamentally flawed.
Yes, flawed from the get-go. He argues it consistently falls into two major repeating errors, fatal fallacies, really.
Okay, what's the first big mistake they kept making?
The first, and maybe the most fundamental, is a philosophical error he calls reification.
Reification.
It's the mistake of taking something abstract, complex, multifaceted, like intelligence, and treating it as if it's a single concrete thing. Like it's a measurable quantity that physically exists in your head, almost like, say, your height or your weight.
I see. Turning an idea into a thing you can supposedly measure precisely? That's a huge leap.
It is. And once you've convinced yourself you can measure this complex thing with just one number, what's the next logical step?
Well, I guess you start comparing people using that number.
Exactly. You commit the second fallacy, ranking. Once you have that number, that reified intelligence score or whatever the ERD becomes almost irresistible. You start ordering people or even whole groups, maybe based on race or class or gender, along a single straight line.
From better to worse.
Precisely. From superior to inferior. Gould's whole mission in the book is to show that this quest for a single number to capture human value is not just scientifically baseless. It's philosophically flawed, and maybe most importantly, it's socially dangerous. Really destructive.
Okay, let's follow his historical trail then.
Mm-hmm.
He starts in the 19th century, right? Before IQ tests, they were literally measuring heads. Craniometry.
That's right, craniometry. The first part of the book dives deep into figures like Samuel George Morton. He was an American physician in the mid-1800s, and he was completely obsessed with using skull-sized cranial capacity to prove a racial hierarchy.
How did he even measure that?
He collected hundreds of skulls from different groups, and he'd measure their internal volume, often by filling them up with, believe it or not, lead shot or sometimes mustard seeds.
Lead shot. Wow, okay. And I'm guessing his results conveniently matched the prejudices of the time.
You guessed it. Morton published tables showing, surprise, surprise, that Caucasians had the largest cranial capacity than Native Americans, with black people having the smallest.
And those numbers were immediately seized upon, I imagine.
Oh, absolutely. They were used instantly as scientific proof to justify slavery, discriminatory policies, the whole racial structure of the time.
But here's where Good the statistician comes in, right? This is the shocking part you mentioned earlier.
Exactly. This is what makes the book so powerful. Gould didn't just dismiss Morton. He went back to Morton's own published data, his original charts and calculations.
He dug into the archives.
He did, to see if the numbers actually said what Morton claimed they said.
What did the reanalysis show? Did Morton find a real hierarchy?
Not at all. Gould uncovered systematic biases. Not necessarily deliberate fraud, he suggests, but unconscious errors driven by expectation.
Like what kind of errors?
Things like conveniently rounding numbers up for white skulls, maybe down for black skulls. Selectively choosing which subgroups to include or exclude.
Ah.
Or failing to account properly for things like body size. Bigger people tend to have bigger heads, regardless of race, but not applying that consistently.
So manipulating the method, maybe without even realizing it.
That's the argument. And once Gould corrected for these biases, recrunched Morton's own numbers using consistent methods.
Poof.
The differences vanished.
The supposed clear racial hierarchy in brain size essentially evaporated. There were no statistically significant differences in the way Morton claimed.
That's devastating. It shows how easily bias can infect data, even seemingly objective measurements.
Precisely. And it wasn't just Morton. Gould shows this pattern repeating. Take Paul Broca, a very famous, sophisticated French anthropologist.
Mm-hmm. I know the name.
Broca was also fixated on proving European male superiority through brain measurements.
Okay, so same goal, maybe more sophisticated methods?
More sophisticated, yes, but just as biased. Gould documents how whenever Broca's data didn't fit his prejudice.
Which must have happened sometimes.
Oh, definitely. Like, he found that some respected French thinkers had distinctly average-sized brains. Or sometimes German men had larger brains than French men, which was awkward for him.
So what did Broca do when the numbers didn't cooperate? He constantly shifted his methodology. He'd invent ad hoc explanations, after the fact rationalizations. Like, well, if a superior man's brain was small, Broca might argue it must be of higher quality. Or if it was average, maybe it was heavier due to better blood flow or something.
He just kept moving the goalposts.
Constantly. Gould paints this picture of a desperate scramble to make the data fit the desired conclusion. The conclusion, European male superiority, was fixed. The scientific details were flexible.
It's a powerful pattern, which leads us, I suppose, into the 20th century and the rise of a new tool, the IQ test. No more skulls, now we measure the mind directly.
Exactly. And this is where the story takes another really dark turn in Gould's view. It starts with the test's inventor, Alfred Binet, in France around the turn of the century.
Okay, Binet. What was his original intention?
Binet was actually quite progressive for his time. He developed his scale, not really an IQ test yet, for a very practical purpose. He wanted a diagnostic tool to help identify Parisian schoolchildren who were struggling and needed extra educational support.
So it was meant to help, not label.
Yes. And crucially, Binet explicitly warned against using his scale to give kids a single fixed score. He hated the idea of labeling children as inherently limited. He saw intelligence as complex and changeable.
But that's not how it played out, especially in America, right?
Not at all. When Binet's ideas crossed the Atlantic, that nuance got completely bulldozed. Figures like Henry H. Goddard and later Lewis M. Terman at Stanford, they seized on the idea of a test, but they fundamentally changed its meaning. They performed that act of reification again.
How so?
They transformed the score into IQ, the intelligence quotient, and they defined it as measuring a single, innate, fixed, hereditary quantity. Your fundamental worth essentially captured in one number.
And they weren't shy about the implications.
Absolutely not. They were very upfront. Goddard used his translated Binet tests at Ellis Island to argue that many immigrants, particularly from Southern and Eastern Europe, were feeble-minded. Terman explicitly linked IQ to eugenics. He believed society should be stratified based on IQ scores, with low IQ individuals discouraged or prevented from reproducing.
Wow. So the tool designed to help struggling kids became a weapon for social control.
That's Gould's argument, yes. And it reached a massive scale during World War I with Robert M. Yerkes.
The Army tests, Alpha and Beta, I've heard of those.
Yes. Yerkes convinced the Army to administer IQ tests, the Alpha for literate recruits, the Beta for illiterate ones or non-English speakers, to over 1 million soldiers.
A huge data set.
Huge, but incredibly messy and biased. The administration was often chaotic. Imagine, you know, illiterate men being given the written Alpha test.
Yeah.
Or tests given in noisy, intimidating group settings.
The conditions sound terrible for getting accurate results.
They were. And the tests themselves were riddled with cultural biases. Questions assumed knowledge specific to American middle-class culture at the time.
So immigrants and poorer recruits were at a huge disadvantage.
A massive disadvantage. Yet despite all these flaws, Yerkes and his team crunched the numbers and published the results.
And what did they find?
They found, quote unquote, that recent immigrants from Southern and Eastern Europe, as well as Black Americans, scored significantly lower on average than Northern Europeans or white Americans.
And this finding had real-world consequences.
Immediate and devastating ones. This flawed data, presented with the authority of science, was used as key evidence in Congress. It directly fueled the arguments for and ultimately helped pass the Immigration Act of 1924.
Which drastically cut immigration from those lower scoring regions.
Exactly. It slammed the door shut based in large part on what Gould demonstrates was fundamentally bad science. Biased tests, poorly administered, misinterpreted.
It's a chilling example of how these ideas aren't just academic.
They shape lives. And finally, Gould takes aim at the statistical technique that seemed to give this whole enterprise its scientific legitimacy, factor analysis and the concept of G.
G for general intelligence, right? Developed by Charles Spearman.
That's the one. Spearman noticed that scores on different kinds of mental tests, verbal, math, spatial reasoning, etc., tended to correlate. People who did well on one often did well on others.
Okay, that makes intuitive sense.
It does. But Spearman and later proponents of G made another huge leap. They said this correlation must mean there's a single underlying real thing, general intelligence, or G, that causes performance across all tests.
So they reified the correlation itself, turned a statistical pattern into a physical entity in the brain.
That is precisely Gould's critique. He argues G is a statistical artifact. It's a mathematical abstraction that emerges from the way the tests are designed and correlated.
Not necessarily a thing in the head.
Exactly. The tests correlate, Gould suggests, because they often measure similar skills, learned in similar cultural and educational contexts, and designed by people with similar assumptions. To then claim this correlation proves a single innate intelligence factor is, for Gould, another major fallacy, a misuse of statistics to bolster biological determinism.
Wow. Okay, so after tracing this whole history, from skulls to G, what are the big overarching themes or messages we should take away from this deep dive?
Well, I think theme number one, loud and clear, is that science is socially embedded. It doesn't happen in a vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
Gould relentlessly shows how the research he examines wasn't just a neutral quest for knowledge. So often the goal was really to find evidence that would confirm existing social hierarchies.
Like white supremacy or class structures.
Exactly. The scientists were products of their time and culture, and their biases shaped their work, consciously or not. We have to remember that context.
Okay, science isn't purely objective. What's next?
Theme two is the direct critique of biological determinism itself. Gould argues it's not just weak science. It's socially pernicious. It's harmful.
How so?
Because if you argue that social inequalities, poverty, lack of achievement are just the natural result of innate biological differences.
And there's nothing society needs to do about it.
Precisely. It rationalizes the status quo. It lets society off the hook for addressing things like discrimination, unequal opportunities, systemic problems. It becomes an excuse for inaction.
That's a powerful point. And the third theme.
The third, and maybe the positive counterpoint, is the call for a pluralistic view of intelligence. The book systematically dismantles this myth of a single, fixed, rankable intelligence.
Right.
Human abilities are incredibly diverse, multifaceted, adaptable. This historical obsession with boiling it all down to one line, one ranking, Gould shows it as a damaging oversimplification, fundamentally biased.
It's clear why the book had such an impact. And Gould's writing itself is pretty memorable, isn't it? He had a way with words.
Oh, definitely. He could blend the technical detail with really powerful social commentary. There are some lines that just stick with you.
Let's talk about a few key ideas or near quotes.
Yeah.
What's one that captures that core error?
I think the essence of the reification problem is key. Paraphrasing him, it's like, once you make that first mistake, converting something complex and abstract like intelligence into a hard number.
Yeah.
Well, the road to ranking people based on that number is short. And it's incredibly treacherous. That initial step is the dangerous one.
Okay, the danger of turning ideas into numbers. What about the human cost?
Well, this is maybe his most famous quote or the sentiment of it. I am somehow less interested in the weight and convolutions of Einstein's brain than in the near certainty that people of equal talent have lived and died in cotton fields and sweatshops.
Wow, that hits hard.
Doesn't it? It just completely reframes the discussion away from innate limits and onto lost potential, onto the critical role of opportunity or the tragic lack of it.
Yeah, it shifts the focus entirely. And maybe one more about data itself.
A crucial warning, I think, is his point that the data never speaks for itself.
Okay.
It is invariably filtered through the matrix of human expectation and bias. It's a reminder to always be critical, always ask where the numbers came from and who interpreted them.
So these ideas have real teeth. How can we apply this thinking in our lives today? What are the practical applications?
I think the most immediate one is just critical thinking. The book is like a training manual for questioning assumptions.
How so?
Especially when you see studies linking complex social outcomes like success or crime or whatever to simple biological causes. Gould teaches you to ask, okay, wait, what are the hidden biases here? What cultural assumptions are baked into this research? Is there reification happening?
Right, questioning the foundation. What about in education?
Huge implications for education and testing. The book makes you deeply skeptical of over-relying on standardized test scores, whether it's IQ or SATs or anything else.
Seeing them as the final word on someone's potential?
Exactly. Instead, it pushes towards embracing what psychologists now call a growth mindset, seeing abilities as things that can be developed that are malleable, rather than using a single test score as a fixed label that limits a child's future or sorts them into tracks.
That seems much more hopeful.
It is. And finally, I'd say it's essential for media literacy.
How we consume science news.
Yeah. You know those pop science headlines? Scientists find the gene for leadership, or brain scan reveals the root of anxiety.
Mm-hmm. See them all the time.
Well, Gould's book gives you a lens. It helps you recognize how often scientific authority, or the appearance of it, gets used to simplify really complex human stuff. And how often, maybe subtly, those simplifications end up justifying existing inequalities. Be skeptical of the easy biological explanation for complex social issues.
That's really useful advice. So as we wrap up, what's the final big takeaway for you from revisiting this book?
For me, it's the profound reminder that science, for all its power, is a deeply human activity. And that means it's fallible. Its authority shouldn't be accepted passively, especially when its conclusions line up maybe a little too neatly with existing social prejudices or power structures. We need to stay critical.
Yeah, that vigilance seems key. For me, I think it's Gould's passionate defense of human dignity.
Yeah.
He pushes back so hard against what he calls this brutal pessimism of biological limits.
Yeah.
You walk away feeling a renewed sense of the unquantifiable complexity and the incredible diverse potential that exists in basically every person. It's a message against limits.
A powerful message, and definitely timeless.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.